Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, April 7th, 2024. I'll begin with a featured article, Larry David's Rule Book for How Not to Live in Society. And then I'll see how much time I have left. I'll try to end with Judge John Hodgman. So, Larry David's rule book for how not to live in society. He's a wild, monomaniacal jerk. He's also our greatest interpreter of American manners since Emily Post. This is a story by Wesley Morris. Suppose you're out to brunch and find yourself in a buffet line that a fellow diner doesn't appear to have noticed. He casually approaches with his plate and tries to serve himself. Do you A, join the hangry mob cursing him, or B, rise to this man's defense because you can see that he's holding a plate, which means he already waited in line and is now returning for another helping? If you're Larry David, not only is the answer B, but the misunderstanding warrants, in your scratchy Brooklyn accent, a triumphant clarification. That's not how we do things here in America. Why, we don't wait for seconds. Never. Larry knows from buffet breaches. He once caught someone pulling what he termed a chat and cut, gaining proximity to food by talking to someone with a choicier position in line. He doesn't like it, but is impressed anyway. I respect your skills. Another time when a restaurant employee accuses him of violating its buffet policy by sharing his plate with his manager and main man Jeff, a lawyer magically appears to clarify for the employees that after a diner purchases a meal, what he does with it is his business. Justice and brunch have been served. But now let's suppose that you're a serious middle-aged woman named Marilyn, and you've decided to host dinner for your new beau's closest friends, and the guests include this Larry David, who you've already had to shoo from the arm of one of your comfy chairs. The group raises a glass and toasts your hospitality. Well, everybody except you-know-who. Susie, who is married to Jeff and clearly finds Larry as much of an irritant as you've begun to, asks, "You can't clink, Larry?" Why should he? Because it's a custom that people do, which is friendly and nice. Larry takes a sip of water and asks the most peculiar question. "What is this, tap?" "It is," his response. Surprised you don't have a filter. Do you A, serve him your coldest glance and withering reply, "You have no filter," or B, ask him to leave your house? If you're Marilyn, you do both. These stories hail from Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is scheduled to deliver its final episode on April 7th. After 12 seasons and 24 years on HBO, in each incident, bald, bespectacled, wiry, wealthy Larry has stepped out of line once physically to defend or offend. I went back and watched the whole series and would like to report that television has never had anything like this show. Nothing is uncouth and contradictory and unhinged, and yet somehow under a tremendous amount of thematic control. Nothing whose calamity doubles as a design for living. It presents the American id at war with its puritanical superego. Sometimes Larry is the one, sometimes he's the other. The best episodes dare him to inhabit the two at once, heretic and Talmudist. Even people who don't watch the show, that's most of the country, seems to know the gist that Larry, as performed by Larry David, is a monstrously entitled crank, the Godzilla of Western Los Angeles. But Curb Your Enthusiasm is about more than Larry's probable narcissism. It's a supreme comedy of manners. how, it asks, do we share a meal, a drive, a party, a meeting, a bathroom, an office pantry, a city? How do we courteously enforce norms and, with modesty, uphold standards? Are courtesy and modesty necessary? It's the only show we have left that's been this curious about, this keen on the fine print of living an ethical, civic life, about interpersonal candor and the maintenance of a kind of civility while also allowing for the liberty of letting you do you. Larry makes liberty with a drink. He is insensitive, selfish, monomaniacal, prone to flagrance, frequently wrong in every single way a person can be wrong, by accident, via misunderstanding, out of malice. He can be a bad friend and has been a lousy husband, a worse boyfriend, a dubious lay, and an iffy boss. Don't go into business with Larry or tell him a secret. Don't invite him to your funeral. Don't rely on him to watch your newsstand so you can pee. Probably, don't be his co-star or co-author either. I've never seen any actor with David's grasp of how to play skepticism for laughs. Eyebrows as up-yanked drawbridge, forehead creases as lasagna of vexation, that raw-boned voice of his soars, if not in octaves, then certainly with a tickly, prickly dynamism. He can shout anyone down. For insinuation and seduction, for seductive insinuation, he can drop it low. David has imbued Larry with so much guilt, exceptionalism, cluelessness, terror, cowardice, innocence, avoidance, vindictive zeal, genuine curiosity, and joie de vivre that the performance becomes what Larry loves, a buffet. Also, what a liar. And yet who else in the last quarter century has done more to insist on some standard of alternative etiquette to speak to the humiliating, exasperating paradoxes of doing just about anything in 21st century America? Larry's plight is ours. His struggle with gratuities and plastic packaging and stop and chats, never to be mistaken for the chat and cut, with dinner party conversation, appropriate in-flight attire, social slights, or trick-or-treaters, with behaving neighborly, compassionately, with spills, stains, rashes, snags, dents, nicks, knocks. He's yours. Larry's confusion about greetings and salutations, about language itself, would crowd an hour-long supercut. Who else in his attempt to do good or simply enjoy himself has been as thoroughly misunderstood, maligned, and stamped pervert, racist, sexist, sick by strangers, friends, their wives, potential mistresses, fundamentalist Muslims, fellow Jews? This, then, is to say that Larry's struggle is also Larry's. He's the apotheosis of unforced error, a person for whom the expression, "Where do you get off?" is eternally meant. The show constitutes a behavioral gestalt. Its stress tests our understanding of how to treat one another and what not to ask, how not to act. Until a few weeks ago, I wouldn't have thought to put it quite this way, but Larry David is Emily Post. He's Amy Vanderbilt. The show is Larry David's complete book of etiquette, his ungraciously gracious guide to living. Curb Your Enthusiasm began in 2000, when TV functioned the old way, on a fixed schedule and network dominated. The top shows still included ER, Friends, Everybody Loves Raymond, expensive, scripted, written, performed. Curb Your Enthusiasm ran on HBO after The Sopranos, a drama that conducted itself with the grittiness and opulence of a major film. early Curb episodes are like a bad independent movie, shakily shot on washed-out video, too tightly framed, misscored, haltingly acted. It was a world away from The Sopranos, an anti-production. But that unkempt, feral quality was a source of the allure. Its episodes are improvised and tend to exceed the 30-minute mark that's still the limit for a network sitcom. The on-the-spot approach to creating comedy brings it closer to the raw timber of documentary. Its wildness matched a chaos brewing around us. That first season wrapped up during the hazy fury that followed the 2000 presidential election. Episode 5 aired the Sunday after Election Day and conducts itself in rancorous spasms. At his doctor's office, Larry makes the gentlemanly choice of letting a woman off the elevator before he exits. It's part of his You First era. But even though Larry has an earlier appointment, the doctor's first-come-first-serve policy means she gets seen before he does, to arousing Larry's spite. "My days of elevator etiquette are over," he declares. Everybody in the episode wields a policy of some kind, for reading scripts, for borrowing cash from strangers, for giving out phone numbers. Their values clash, sometimes violently, with Larry's. You might be looking for trouble, marrying Curb Your Enthusiasm to a political climate, but politics do suffuse the show. They're social and correspondent with the new century's choleric base layer. There's no one whom Larry won't go up against. Seniors, Girl Scouts, Lin-Manuel Miranda, most of the show's run occurred during the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. If war, national security, recession, police killings of Black Americans, fraying democracy, hate crimes, and a pandemic were tearing the country apart, belligerents looked different within the world of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Its vision sidestepped sweeping philosophy. It rarely sought bigger fish to fry, nor was it ever content to shoot them in a barrel. As Americans' distrust in unifying systems, like the truth, the social safety net, ballooned, as we grew ever more trollish, more righteous, more tolerant of tumult and of the dissolution of certain rules, the show didn't waver. It luxuriated in the bawdy, tactless, and loony. For God's sake, its theme song conjures a clown's circus suite, whoopee cushion tuba, banana peel woodwinds. The headlines, when they perforate this fiction, wind up beneath its big top. This isn't so much a matter of the show zagging while the national mood zigs, although there is that. It's a pointed acknowledgement that most of us have no idea what the national news is, let alone the mood. We do know that it's Tuesday, which means alternate side parking, which means doing etiquette battles in the street. For gaseous, macrocosmic poli-sci, people can turn to Aaron Sorkin. For gripes about the stale array of doctor's office magazines, there's been Larry. Nonetheless, the show couldn't help capturing attention in our ideas of propriety. Is sampling, I don't know, 7 flavors of ice cream considerate when Larry's right behind you? How about 2? Divisive stuff. The show identified a shift in comportment toward shamelessness. The character, actor Robin Bartlett, plays the 7-flavor sampler. When Larry tells her off, when he says what we've all thought, "Seriously? Another sample?" Bartlett conjures more than unfazed as she makes her exit, having almost villainously settled on vanilla. She is tickled by his rage. The show's disharmony over not nothing, over what for a Tuesday can be everything, was on to and up to something. It understood the cheap delight some of us take in eliciting exasperation. By 2000, television's protagonists were undergoing a nearly identical makeover that prized antagonism, a transition lubricated by Seinfeld, the sitcom David helped create. It ended 2 years earlier, and on Curb is the reason Larry enjoys some celebrity and is set for life. We call the new archetypes anti-heroes. Only Larry's brand of anti-heroism, insouciance, insolence, disregard for other people's wishes, cries out for an adjacent designation, one that honors his rudeness, his monomania, his unsolicited two cents, both his indifference to and pleasure in the sour reactions his behavior sometimes garners. Larry is an asshole. This is scarcely news in Lar-Lar land. You could compose another extended supercut of the numbers of times the show's other characters have stamped him with that. David's timing was perfect. Survivor, also premiered in 2000, became America's top-rated TV show, opening a portal to a form of television ruled by these people. Reality TV, where the country's lofty policy crises weren't the going concern either. This version of the genre sloshed around in grubby, conniving interpersonal manipulations and captivating personalities that cast members wanted either to impress or vanquish. Here was a less varnished landscape of avatars for our co-workers, bosses, neighbors, acquaintances, hookups, bad dates, and in-laws. What fun to watch them squabble and squirm. Reality's parallel universe, Premium Cable, had long been a haven for the type. HBO alone has been a white jerk paradise. The Larry Sanders Show, The Mind of the Married Man, The Sopranos, Da Ali G Show, Lucky Louie, Samantha Jones, Valerie Cherish, Amy Jellicoe, every one of Danny McBride's comedies, Girls, Veep, Game of Thrones, Succession, The White Lotus, even amid that company, Curb Your Enthusiasm distinguished itself. Its jerk created a crisis for everybody else. How do we live with, work for, work alongside this guy? Is this guy me? The show's interest in comportment always felt ripe for a completely online age. Curb has no native facility for gadgetry and apps. Its big font, flip phone personality is part of its old ways appeal. Yet gradually, modern technology has crept into the show when Cheryl Hines, who has contributed an appalled chirpiness to the stock sitcom wife, phones Larry from a plane she swears is going to crash. He is more worried about the TiVo guy leaving before the job is finished. And the opening episode of this final 12th season pits a furious Larry against a nonchalant Siri. Still, it's very offline. What it personifies instead is the internet's clashing, bludgeoning moods over identity politics and politics. One way of looking at social media tribalism is as a symptom of our sense of powerlessness, even when some of the techiest tribesmen are the ones with all the power. That's techiest. Tribesmen are the ones with all the power. The show has always struck me as a perversely optimistic, perfectly basic rebuke. Holding these codes of conduct, picayune and crazy-making as they may seem, is how a disordered culture strives for order. In real life, the comedy of coexistence tends to sparkle less. Often it feels terrible. You appreciate the padding of a Larry-esque moment when a Larry-worthy confrontation chafes you. One evening last October, I was biking down a sidewalk in my neighborhood, whose charms include its cobblestone streets. Usually to avoid the rumbling bumps of the final block, I opt for concrete, which isn't kosher, but it's convenient. I don't have to do much to ensure no one's walking past this patch of sidewalk, because no one ever is. This particular night, however, I shared the pavement with a man walking two dogs. He was stooping to gather their leavings when I announced that I was passing on his right. "Get off the expletive sidewalk." "Excuse me?" "You heard me. Get off the expletive sidewalk." He took a look at my bike and motioned toward the tires. "What are those, 32s? They can handle cobblestones. I ride. Nobody's more bike-friendly than me. Sidewalks are for pedestrians." "Sir, why the anger?" "Because I'm tired of people like you coming into my neighborhood riding on the expletive sidewalks." "Sir, I am your neighbor." "Well, then you know in this neighborhood we handle the cobblestones." I told him what street I lived on. "Good for you. Stay off the expletive sidewalk." Here I should say that this man was long, balding, middle-aged, bespectacled. Larry, essentially. I followed him up the block, futilely deploying neighborly contrition to defuse him. But neighborliness wasn't his concern. He wanted to be rid of me because I represented either a composite of policy breaches or a wave of racial ones. My spidey sense tingled. So I retreated, still asking, though, from a widening distance, why he was so furious and receiving only F-bombs in return. A few minutes later, putting my bike away, I thought about why the altercations on Curb Your Enthusiasm are so magnetic. Justice has something to do with it. So does personal certitude. There's a way to do things, and I know what it is. There's also the show's music. It conjures the circus, yes, but it's also an old world as the values are old-fashioned. Larry loves to invoke the golden rule. The music excuses, mocks, farcifies, soothes. It evokes klezmer, polka, and vaudeville. This melodiousness of Jewish tradition, of which Larry is a part, assaying the large type and fine print of American life with the same meticulous relish as Mel Brooks, Woody Allen, and Albert Brooks. The music reminds you that the stakes are ancient but low, that there's no danger in the show's world that is inexorable. The music is transitional, but it's a binding agent too. It helps make the city a village, a shtetl. I've tried to imagine how scenes on the show might feel without it. Different kind of ridiculous, I guess. Ominously ridiculous. Me chasing a stranger who has reduced me to my infraction, who is maybe convinced that an infraction is all I am. The show's trivial obsessions, more or less turning the hunt for whose drink left a ring on an antique table into an episode of Murder, She Wrote, do seek to address grand questions. Are we our misbehavior, our shame, our opprobrium? Is there ever any point in pleading to be heard out? So many times Larry has been caught in the middle of what appears to be an insult or obscenity, beep locking his car as a black man passes, humping a sex doll that really he was only struggling to deflate. Is there no defense that would de-escalate the altercation, no clarification that would exonerate? That night with my neighborhood Larry, it wasn't forgiveness I was chasing him for. I think it was grace, and it hurt to discover that I warranted none. I like to think that Larry David himself would have stopped to consider my case. At this time, the show has been wondering, how much decency must we demonstrate to be worth keeping around? What's a tolerable balance of crank and good Samaritan? With Larry, we've been watching that meter fluctuate for 24 years, but the needle's position has yet to cost him his most meaningful people. After the TiVo incident, Cheryl falls in love with someone else and leaves Larry. But they remain in each other's lives. So does his friend Marty Funkhauser, Bob Einstein, who would be within his rights to eternally expunge Larry simply for the time at Marty's father's funeral, that Larry removed from the coffin a golf club he was convinced belonged to him. Why should this guy be buried in eternity with my club? That's not fair. It's not that Larry is loved per se. He's tolerated. But on Curb Your Enthusiasm, tolerance constitutes a type of love. Larry has never lacked for a seat at anybody's table, even when the odds are good that he'll be asked to vacate it. Tolerance is another way to think about etiquette, not blindly, constructively, perhaps. The show has been a marvel of that, constructive tolerance. Tolerating Larry is, as Susie would say, and does, a nice thing to do. Emily posts Etiquette in Society, in Business, in Politics, and at Home, made its debut in 1922, and argued that in what she called best society, we owe one another our finest selves. The book covers everything from formal introductions to declining invitations to courteous shopping. A centenary edition by two of Post's heirs is less fussy and a little cooler. It includes an entry on pronouns. The Larry of Curb would seem inveterately Post-proof. And yet, in the show's inaugural episode, when he denounces a girlfriend of his best friend, Richard Lewis, for not getting up from her seat at the movies so he can scooch past, and Richard defends her by saying she reads Elie Wiesel, Larry explodes. You know what she should be reading? Emily expletive Post. Etiquette is a pact. In a functional society, it's also an offering of goodness, decency, forbearance, and respect. A flavor of the social contract in which we all pay a small personal freedom tax so that everyone feels accommodated. The offering risks rejection, risks offense. Some people just won't care about their civic duty. They won't care that you're performing years. Some of them won't care with zeal. Curb Your Enthusiasm takes up that risk. It's Emily Post with boxing gloves. Larry is hardly the show's only offender. It knows too well that we all have our moments, our things. Clanging indifference are what drive the show. And through it, I spy Post's ideal out on some faraway horizon, an ideal we call America. It taps into a puritanical force so strong that etiquette becomes an almost religious expression of gentry. We're not even sure how we've come to abide by it. Susie Essman, has been the show's true superego, there to zap Larry and curse his transgressions. Her denouncements are bangers, but they always come down to what she once tells him after he more or less asks whose rule he broke. I don't know the derivation, she snips. It's just not done. On this show, no stable etiquette emerges. Susie's version is aspirational and oriented toward propriety. She's a proud Jewish woman whose etiquette tax seems to entail the public tamping of her full ethnic self. A stern Japanese man, Mr. Takahashi, Dana Lee, owns the country club Larry belongs to and insists upon a strict etiquette of his own that, come season 12, the membership has revolted against. For the last 7 seasons, Larry has had a housemate named Leon, J.B. Smoove, a do-ragged sex machine who has surmounted an entertainment stereotype to provide a haven for Larry's insecurities and a resource on etiquette. No, Larry, you can't break up with a woman in a wheelchair or anybody over the phone. And its black alternative, which often entails slipping into and out of respectability. In other words, within that pact resides variety, the ideal that etiquette might aim to provide is harmony. But America has always made its attainment laughable. We are a nation of etiquettes. Well, for the show's purposes, we're a Los Angeles of etiquettes, a New York of them. It identifies etiquette as an MRI of our character, as glue for our communities. To build a data set, its makers have sized, has sicked, have, to build a data set, its makers have sicked Larry on us. He's simultaneously our great crusader against shoddy parking, wobbly cafe tables, and getting together for no reason, and a white man run amok, telling you he knows better than you how your gender is best expressed, what your true sexual or personality orientation is, how to rear your child. He is a white man who has managed to upset and insult us all. And at this point, I do mean all of us. Every service professional, every race, every executive, every religion, every body. And yet, crucially, nearly every single time, he is told off, cast out, ignored, tisked, dumped, pitchforked, closed in on. For the one thing Larry has never been, until April 7th at least, is canceled. I've thought about that over these three decades. What it has required to tolerate this man. I've worried whether my attraction to this show, my fascination with him, is akin to devotion to the brashness of a certain former president of the United States. But I remember that Larry has never cried witch hunt or fake news. He has no lackeys, no suck-ups, no enablers. What Larry has is friends, and a friend lets you know when enough is enough. Larry isn't irredeemable. He can admit defeat, can confess that when you're wrong, you're wrong, that I'm hoisted on my own petard. When his mouth doesn't say mea culpa, his body does. That, I think, is what we've been watching this show to experience, Larry's duality. The whole other side of his character and David's performance radiates warmth, generosity, concern, and devotion. Joy in people, belief in them, patience for even those of us in error. Empathy stirs within him. He can attach strings, but can snip them too. The man whose defense he came to at that brunch place, Larry served him potatoes. The splits in Larry's personality inform the show's journey to the heart of manners, as does his Jewishness. His contrarianism refuses him even a harbor among his people, because ultimately he's still him and they're still people. What amount of etiquette justifies surrendering to the whole American shebang, particularly if you've gleaned the country's etiquette biases? His explanation of mezuzah to the handyman preparing to install one outside Larry's front door is a practical blasphemy. This is like a Jewish thing, you know. You put it over the door so that every anti-Semite in the neighborhood will know that we live here in case they want to burn down the house. David's performance basks in the terrible awkwardness of being someone you suspect everybody already hates. He hails from a people who followed the rules and lost everything anyway. And yet here's Larry, trying and trying, in spite of history, in spite of himself. He seems to know, as divine as it would be to inhabit and maintain some universal standard of comportment. This is the United States, a nation enthralled by the idea of absolute freedom, of being absolutely right. The show knows that we're too black, too white, too Spanish-speaking, too Jewish, too Muslim, too bald, too disabled, too mentally unwell, too affluent, too impoverished, too straight, too Asian diasporic, too MAGA, too two-party system, too Tesla, too TikTok to stay on the same page for long. And yet, thinking about what it takes to actually make this show, that it's improvised, which means that it's people standing around behaving together for comedy, for a comedic truth that here becomes absurdist human truth. To improvise isn't necessarily to know, it's to search, to try, to fail, to trust, to negotiate. This show has been the work of funny people. As it progressed, you could detect some of them barely keeping it together. This would be a breach of comedy etiquette. Laughing at your own jokes is a no-no. But the show has known that the stakes of civility are too high not to crack up from time to time. Consider the alternative. If they weren't laughing, we'd be crying. The author Wesley Morris is a Time critic who writes about art and popular culture. I'll read a letter of recommendation. The case against good coffee. Instant coffee tastes just okay. That's fine with me. A story by Peter C. Baker. Not long ago, I went through a long period during which I awoke every morning with absolutely no desire to make coffee. Don't misunderstand, I still wanted to drink the stuff, with a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old waking me up around, if I was lucky, 6 in the morning. I relied on coffee's sharpening effect more than ever. I was just tired of working for it. Picking which beans to use that day, I was always buying beans. Grinding them, placing the grounds in the filter, wiping up the grounds that spilled on the counter, measuring out the water, waiting. Not long ago, I loved the ritual of it all. Together, the steps were part of the machinery I employed to coax myself into consciousness and face the day. But now I didn't want to be coaxed. I wanted to be woken up as fast as possible so I could tend to my kids. The routine had, at some point, devolved into yet another chore, especially once I started forgetting to empty the filter when I was done, leaving as a gift for my future self an unpleasant deposit of sodden grounds. One day in the grocery store, I found a solution staring me in the face in the form of a surprisingly large array of instant coffee options. Experience had taught me that it tasted horrible. In my 20s, I worked abroad at a newspaper staffed largely by expat British journalists who drank Nescafe as if it were water. I wondered what, historically, culturally, could explain this. Maybe the Blitz? Nescafe tasted to me like something formulated in a malicious lab experiment involving dust and cinders and few, if any, coffee beans. Didn't help that the dehydrated crystals resembled the droppings of a small disease-carrying rodent. The instant coffees I encountered more recently on the grocery store shelf looked exactly the same, albeit in some instances in slicker packaging, adorned with stylish labels. Maybe, I told myself, instant had improved. Next morning, up again with the kids, I spooned a heaping teaspoon of instant coffee crystals into a mug, poured in the hot water, and that was it. Process done. The coffee was fine. Not as good as a cup of freshly roasted, single-origin, shade-grown made at my favorite shop, but it was recognizably coffee. There was no process worth speaking of to enjoy, but there were no grounds on the counter either, and I soon felt the caffeine caressing my synapses. If I had to pick one word to describe the process, that word would be instant. And if I had to pick one word to describe how this simplified process made me feel, that word would be good. Instant coffee reminded me why I started on coffee as a college student. I didn't bring coffee into my life because I especially liked the taste of it or appreciated the distinction between different roasting methods or bean types. I was aware, mostly from the examples of classmates and the movies, that it could magically reconfigure my energies, creating pockets of alertness where they otherwise might not have existed. Life, then, felt like an adventure I could arrange as I saw fit, and coffee was a tool that helped me do that. Once, coffee kept me awake so I could pick up a love interest at the airport at midnight. In my car, I felt like the hero of a fantasy story, slipping beneath the surface of the sleeping world to find another realm underneath, one where people were still in motion, still working and playing and chasing after what they wanted long after polite society had gone to sleep. Afterward, we went to a diner we liked. It was the same as always, but it felt completely new. All the familiar details, the grilled cheese, the mustard, were little notes stitched into a broader symphony of wonder and surprise. Over time, coffee became less of a novel superpower and more of a familiar default, something I counted on and rarely took the time to be amazed or even especially delighted by. You would be forgiven for thinking otherwise, looking at my recipes for beans over the years, or assessing the arsenal of coffee tools I had acquired, all the grinders and filters and special little scoops, the multiple French presses, the mocha pot I bought in grad school and can't find anymore, the workhorse drip machine that remains the best way to make coffee for a group. Yet these tools somehow produced coffee that tasted good. Yes, they became familiar, comforting parts of my morning. But my experiments and purchases were motivated less by an innate lust for superior coffee and more by a vague sense, absorbed osmotically from my cultural milieu, that better coffee was something adults strive for. Instant coffee renewed my appreciation for the alchemical powers that drew me to coffee in the first place. The previous night's dishes were still piled in the sink and on the counter. My son was using maple syrup to trace an indecipherable design on the kitchen table. My daughter's Cheerios were on the floor, and she had a look in her face that made clear she would soon need a diaper. The scene wasn't anyone's idea of a soothing wake-up ritual, but coffee helped me hear that beautiful music of wonder and surprise. Old habits, coffee-related and otherwise, are gathering dust in the cabinets of my life, but in the space created by their absence, new life comes streaming in. More of it every instant. Peter C. Baker, the author, is the author of the novel Plains, Knopf, 2022. I'll read another letter of recommendation. The retro music genre that will change your life. Classic rock rules. When the right song comes on the radio, I pretty much see God. Story by Nate Rogers. Distilled to its purest essence, rock music, my genre of choice, is somewhat embarrassing. I usually enjoy a Kiss song when I hear it, for instance. I wish you luck trying to resist the power, pop, perfection of Strutter. But I would still prefer that no one walk in on me while it's playing. Doesn't anyone knock anymore? There are plenty of artful examples of rock music, definitely, but its power stancing DNA will always be grown adults in silly outfits screaming about their broken hearts. I don't get the impression that Spotify, which I use often, values the questionable excesses of rock and roll quite the way I do. That's not necessarily a terrible thing. Nobody should just be sitting around listening to arena rock from the 70s. But I have a theory about why the streaming giant favors certain softer styles of music. Perhaps the most ideal streaming customer is one who uses a service while working, racking up hours of passive plays. But you cannot have Kiss on while you work. You'll quickly get irritated with the repetition of the obnoxious lyrics or the tinny production and want to switch to something more pacifying. And Spotify will be more than happy to offer an alternative, having become quite adept at recommending music that hits the spot, song after song, through its autoplay algorithm. My experience with letting Spotify take the wheel is that I find that it finds music that sits pleasantly in the background, and while listening with autoplay on, my environs are like a coffee shop, no matter where I am. In other words, the platform doesn't really get nor effectively push the core of the subgenre I crave most of all, classic rock. You're probably familiar with the peculiar distinctions of classic rock, even as they continue to morph in real time. Based on what classic rock DJs tend to play, we're talking about music made from the mid-60s to the early aughts at this point. Sorry, I don't like that any more than you do. But the songs are not determined by age so much as feel. Hubba Stank's schmaltzy hit, The Reason, is more than 20 years old now, though you would not classify it as classic rock. Red Hot Chili Peppers' war-torn ballad, Scar Tissue, however, released just a few years earlier, fits the bill. Classic rock is music you could see a suburban father listening to on a speaker while washing his car in the driveway. Painfully masculine, beautifully simple. Take that car out of the driveway, and an alternative to streaming-induced banality awaits. I found myself tuning into 95.5 KLOS, K-L-O-S, my local classic rock station, as I drive around the concrete sprawl of Los Angeles, which is an easy place to get sentimental about rock history. Turn a corner, and there's Whiskey a Go-Go. There's Laurel Canyon. There's Sunset Sound. Leather pants wearing ghosts everywhere you look. L.A. was not built on subtlety, and it's often best to commune with it at a high volume. A little bit of added radio crackle is fine. Everything is grimy here. Of course, the sugar blast of the most carnal rock songs cannot alone constitute a healthful diet, but a little can be rejuvenating. On my own, I would never fire up Motley Crue's Kickstart My Heart, and I doubt Spotify would serve it to me through autoplay. I'm thankful for that. Makes it me feel as if I need a shower afterward, but total abstention from a song that catchy is like never indulging in a milkshake. And certain peaks of rock history are well established for a reason. After hearing Jimi Hendrix's Voodoo Child approximately 10 times in 1 month, I'm convinced there's no moment more musically exhilarating than when the full band kicks in. And every time I hear Tom Petty sing about having the radio on and running down a dream while I too have the radio on, I pretty much see God. At one point recently when a Klaus DJ seamlessly transitioned Bob Seger's Hollywood Nights into the Cars, Just What I Needed, I almost burst out of my Prius. But the classic rock I enjoy is not the only reason I tune into Klaus. What I'm also looking for is the music I despise. How else would I know that Grand Funk Radio did a 6-minute cover of Gimme Shelter? I'm drawn to the genre's goofy idiosyncrasies. I cannot help laughing at James Hetfield every time I hear him end a line in a Metallica song with, ah. I've heard that whenever there's a hair metal song too vague and cliched to place initially, the chorus comes on and it's always the Scorpions. For every legitimately classic rock song Klaus plays, there's another that makes the argument for rewriting the genre. Maybe it's a masochistic impulse to seek out this kind of inconsistency. But I can sense that after my first decade of streaming, I've become more prone to complacency. I like listening to rock and roll, not to accent my world, but rather to draw my active attention. So, to keep my ears sharp, that means occasionally resetting my brain with the loudest, brashest music in the canon, for better or for worse. Sometimes that's a spectrum captured within one simultaneously terrible, amazing song, like Kiss's undeniably catchy Lick It Up. And then, after an hour or so of this process, classic rock gives me back something crucial that streaming has been slowly taking away: the desire to turn the music off. Nate Rogers is a writer in Los Angeles. His writing has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, The Ringer, Stereo Gum, and elsewhere. And from The Ethicist, should I speak out when I overhear a person saying something hateful? I was in a barber shop in a town west of Mississippi and east of the Rockies. I didn't hear what had been said before or what came after, but I suddenly heard another customer quite calmly say, "I just wish all homosexuals would be obliterated. I'm gay and have had nightmares about being in a concentration camp because of my sexuality." Hearing those words said out loud froze my blood. I didn't make a scene, just sat and pondered it all for a minute, then got up and walked out. I didn't want to knowingly breathe the same air as someone speaking the language of Nazis. Should I have spoken out? And the ethicist writes, "Some years ago, I was in Budapest at one of those ruined bars that pop up there in odd corners, and one of my drinking companions, a person with intertwined literary and civil rights careers, suddenly stood up and made his way over to a table of young men. He had been a dissident under Hungary's communist regime and was something of a dissident under its current Fidesz party government. Not knowing Hungarian, I can only characterize his tone, reproving, but not antagonistic. He explained, when he returned, that he'd overheard one of the young men using a slur for gay people, and that he made a habit of correcting his compatriots whenever he heard them speaking contemptuously about gays, or Jews, or Romani, or another such disfavored group, none of which he was personally a member of. These teaching moments happened quite a bit. And though I don't know that he was ever slugged in response, he would not have been discouraged if he were. That's the sort of person he was. As I look back, it's clear I wouldn't have found what he did so admirable if I thought he was doing it merely the moral minimum, fulfilling what was required of him. I don't think one is obliged to confront everyone who says reprehensible things. I do think it would be better if more of us did so. So you didn't have a duty to call out the guy, but if you judged it was safe to do so, you might, as you were leaving, have simply pointed out that there are gay people and people who care about someone who's gay everywhere you go, and that it was a bad idea to assume he wouldn't be overheard by one of them. Even if he wanted to be overheard, there are tactical advantages to invoking social norms as a proxy for moral condemnation. Of course, it would have been good if a straight person had spoken up, too. Enforcing norms of basic decency helps challenge the atmosphere of homophobia. In this case, it might have undermined the seeker's confidence that he had conversational permission to wish for the obliteration of millions of human beings. My Hungarian dissident, for all his charm and persistence, knew he wasn't going to change the customs of his country by himself. Still, people like him make the world just a little bit kinder. And I'll close with Judge John Hodgman on getting angry at someone for things they did in a dream. Their justification? Whatever happened in the dream is something I would have done. Stephanie writes, "Sometimes my husband wakes up angry at me for something I did in his dream. He feels he's justified because whatever happened in his dream is something, quote, I would have done. I say this is not fair." And the judge writes, "I hate to say it, but you do seem like a person who would do something mean to your husband in his dreams while riding a sandworm from Dune. Except suddenly it's not Dune anymore. It's me watching the red balloon in my high school French class. Weird, because there's virtually no dialogue in that movie, except when the balloon tells me my mouth is full of crickets. Wait, that's not real. That's just the dream I had last night, probably. I'm sorry, I forgot that dreams are just stories my brain writes for itself, and they're dumb, junk narratives made of half-memory and fear that mean nothing and are definitely not your fault. I'll have to remind your husband when I see him tonight in the form of Gene Hackman, except with a third eye in his forehead and cheese for teeth." Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.